I've been a commercial real estate lawyer for the past 45 years. The storm surge was unexpected to come up the West Coast. We could see the water starting to breach the sand dunes. We lost over 70 cars to water damage. We had 50 people at our gate ready to start shoveling. FEMA didn't cover any damage in our elevator pits. Communication and transparency is really essential.
Welcome to the Florida Association Excellence Podcast, where we showcase the leaders who are transforming residential communities across Florida. I'm your host, Craig Smith, managing partner, Pinnacle Security Access Solutions, and partner with Pinnacle Community Association Management. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Jeffrey Lenoble, board president at the Sanctuary at Longboat Key Club Community Association, who has led some remarkable initiatives that we'll explore together. With over 25 years alongside HOAs and condominiums, I've seen how visionary leadership makes all the difference, and that's exactly what we'll discuss today. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Craig. Thanks for having me.
So to get started, I thought we'd start with talking a little bit about your history, you know, how you got to where you are today in the community leadership position, how your career influenced that or helped you along the way with what you're doing today, and I'll hand it over to you.
Sure. I've been a commercial real estate lawyer for the past 45 years, worked my entire career in large law firms in New York, the last 30 years with the same law firm. I'm sort of semi-retired at this point, but I'm still of counsel with Chulte Roth & Zabel, which is one of the premier law firms. I like to think of the country. We have about 500 lawyers. I was chair of the real estate department there for many years. And I got sort of hoodwinked to become on the board of my cooperative apartment in New York City after we moved to the city from the suburbs. On Longboat Key, where I am right now, my dad actually bought a condominium on Longboat Key in 1969, when Longboat Key was nothing more than a barrier island with a couple of condominiums on it. He later retired there in the early 1990s, subsequently became mayor of Longboat Key for three terms and sat on the town commission there for 14 years. I've started coming down to Longboat Key in 1970, so I've been coming down for well over 50 years at this point, and I've seen quite a bit of change in Longboat Key since then. My wife and I first bought an apartment, a small apartment in 1995, and then we moved to the Sanctuary in 2009. Sanctuary is a beautiful condominium complex. It comprises 18 and a half acres, 1,300 feet of gulffront private beach property, three swimming pools, total of 181 units, five buildings of all different sizes, from 16 units to 63 units. And I think my real estate background sort of led the president of the community association years ago to say, I think someone with your expertise is needed. So I sort of got hoodwinked into joining the board of the Sanctuary Community Association. I also became president of the Condominium Association. We have four condominium associations and one overall community association at the Sanctuary. And I became president after our prior president retired. I guess it was in 2018. He resigned from the board. I think his 3 years was enough. My 6 years has also been enough too, but especially last summer when a couple of hurricanes came through the area and it became a very busy summer with regard to the Sanctuary, and it became a very busy winter here as well, trying to grapple with all the issues that were a result of both Hurricane Helene and Milton. Craig, I don't know if you want me to just delve right into that.
We can ask you a few questions and we'll kind of lean into that because, yeah, you've talked a little bit about the actual community itself because the listeners want to know, like, what are you leadership of, the size, or what, and you talked a little bit about that in the overall.
I'd be glad to go into that. The Sanctuary, I have some facts and figures here. We're about 18 and a half acres, 181 units. We have, our unit sizes range from about 1,800 square feet to 3,900 square feet. Most of the views have beautiful panoramic views of the Gulf of Mexico and the city. We have three pools. One of the pools is a Olympic size pool. Then we have a jacuzzi pool, a kiddie pool. We have two tennis courts. We have a clubhouse with a catered kitchen. We have 24-hour concierge service. We have a gated concierge in each of our buildings. We have a 24/7 gatehouse with a gatehouse attendant. And our management is all on-site management. We don't really outsource any of our management. Our association fees are pretty high. They're basically approximately $3,000 to $4,000 a month, depending upon the building. We pay them quarterly. Our management is great. We have our in-house maintenance staff, in-house building concierge attendants, an in-house general manager, client services, and assistant general manager. So we have about 15 to 20 people on staff at most of the year. They basically take care of everything. It's really been quite a chore. Years ago, we did have some outside management, but unlike other condominiums, we feel that our in-house management serves us well, as our management really gets to know our shareholders extremely well. Our client services manager just retired after being at the Sanctuary for 31 years. Sanctuary was built in the early 1990s. She's been with us for 31 years. We had a big party. I think most every unit owner has taken Pat out to dinner to thank her. So she's been having a great few weeks here, going out to dinner with everyone and not getting her office cleaned up so she can leave at the end of April as she was supposed to. She's still coming in almost on a daily basis. So we have a staff that's been here quite a long time. Our maintenance staff has been here quite a long time. It's getting harder and harder to get help on Longbow Key as the Sarasota community sprawls a little bit and living quarters become a little more difficult for our employees to find adequate, affordable living quarters in the Sarasota area. So they've moved further out, and the traffic during January, February, and March leaving and entering the Key has become an issue. I've always been involved in town governance to a great extent, and we're trying to alleviate some of the traffic concerns that we have January, February, and March. I would say in a survey that was just taken by all of the both seasonal and full-time residents of Longbow Key, the one issue that seemed to sit in the forefront was traffic. Quality of life is still, I think, at 97% satisfactory or more than satisfactory on these surveys, but traffic has become an issue, especially in the 3 months. And so we're trying to deal with that. There's road construction going on, but we really have a two-lane road with a middle turning lane that goes through the 13 miles of Longbow Key, and it's going to be hard to deal with. But there is a 10-year plan to overhaul the road. Make it more rideable, but certainly you can't widen it. And so during the season, it's tough. This is a great time of season to be. The weather's on Longbow Key. The weather's still perfect. Many of the seasonal residents have already left. There's no traffic. You can get into restaurants now in Sarasota. So a great time of year to be in the Sarasota area, which I love. I think my family has been coming down here for over 50 years. My wife and I, who are celebrating our 50th anniversary, we came here even 2 years before we were married and spent a couple of months here. And my kids have been here probably, who are now in their 40s, have been here every year of their life, at least for a visit. My grandchildren have been here every year of their life. And so the Sarasota area and Longbow Key in particular are really part of where we've been.
Yeah, we could touch on where you are, because I think listeners, this is across all of Florida, may not know that you are a barrier island. And we had a lot of hurricanes here that are unusual for us, and that did impact you. So just could you talk about that a little bit?
So Hurricane Helene started entering the Gulf of Mexico in September, and it started aiming towards the sort of panhandle, the curve from the mainland to the panhandle. But the storm surge was sort of unexpected to come up the west coast of Florida in the manner that it did. Mm-hmm. And so there were people who were, including us, who were sort of unprepared until a day or two before the storm hit. Actually, the center of Helene never came closer than 100 miles from Longboat Key, as Craig indicated, is a barrier island off Sarasota on the south side and Bradenton on the, sort of on the north side. And it stretches really the entire length from Sarasota to Bradenton. It's about 13 miles in length. And the storms hit us somewhat of a surprise. We had many residents who stayed in our complex while the storm was approaching, even though they were told that the bridge that goes from Sarasota to Longboat Key was going to be closed and water service was going to be shut down. Water, all of the water on Longboat Key comes from Manatee County. But people elected to stay. They filled up pots of water. They filled their bathtub of water. And they started showing us videos as the storm hit. And we could see the water starting to breach the sand dunes and starting to flow through our buildings and starting to enter into our first floor garages and entering into our swimming pools and entering into the lobbies on two of our buildings that had lobbies at the lower base level. Three of our buildings' lobbies were a little raised and were sort of spared. And as the water came in, we started getting pictures of the water infiltrating into our buildings. Our first floor is all inside garages. I happened to lose two cars to water damage. The insurance adjuster came to look at my cars and in 90 seconds emailed me and said, "We'll arrange for a tow truck to come and take your car away. It's gone." You know, said water can rust the undercarriage of a car within 48 hours. So my two cars were gone. We lost over 70 cars at the sanctuary that were left here during the summer months. The key and Longboat Key lost thousands and thousands of cars. And you could see, even for the months after the storm, the tow trucks and the flatbeds just taking cars off the key for literally for months. In any event, we luckily from Helene did not suffer any damage in our units, other than one unit who had put in new windows that weren't quite ready for a storm like this, but basically suffered, and a balcony railing that came down, we believe, was hit by a flying rock. But other than that, units really suffered no or minimal damage at all. But our ground floors, which are garages and in two of our buildings, lobbies, were totally destroyed. We had 3.5 feet of muck in our garages. Fortunately, after many conference calls between members of the board and management, we had arranged for a recovery service team to come in right when the bridge would reopen. And the first day that the Longboat Key Sarasota Bridge reopened, they call it the Ringling Bridge, reopened, we had 50 people at our gate ready to start shoveling the muck from our internal streets and our garages. And they were here for several weeks cleaning out the garages, cleaning out the streets, shoveling out of the pool. Our landscaping was pretty much destroyed. Our irrigation system was pretty much destroyed. Our tennis courts were pretty much destroyed. Our pool, our filtering system, our electrical board controlling the pool and its filtering system, totally destroyed. Our bathroom by our pool was pretty much destroyed. We had pretty severe property damage. Luckily, no unit damage, which was pretty amazing. And nobody got hurt. Yeah. So yeah, it was property damage. And we learned a lot of lessons. We learned the lesson about FEMA insurance, which we can get to whenever you'd like to get to it. But we had our recovery staff come in, really clean out the place. Our garages were opened within a week. Our pool was opened within 2 or 3 weeks. And we were set to go as the season really opened up in October and people started coming back. Most of our community is seasonal. Say we have maybe 10 to 20% of our residents are full-time residents, but most of our residents are here for, I would say, 6 to 7 months. We have a lot of residents from states that have income tax issues, and so they need to be out of their states for, or they need to be show that Florida is their residence more than 6 months a year. So we have a lot of Canadians who can't be here 6 months a year, but we have a lot of people from New York, Massachusetts, and some of them in Western states who are here for 6+ months a year. So in October, we start getting the influx of people, and we were in pretty good shape by the time they came.
Excellent. We did touch on FEMA. So I think that FEMA is one of those topics that's very confusing to a lot of people. And the listeners might find that interesting because you heard a lot about it in the news and there's a lot of confusion about it. So if you want to touch on.
Yeah, I can certainly tell you about FEMA. So we learned a lot about FEMA insurance. FEMA insurance is pretty interesting. First of all, the first thing you have to find out is whether your building is classified as an elevator building on the FEMA National Flood Insurance Program, because this can affect both costs and coverage. If you are an elevated building, which means you don't have any residences on the first floor, although you may save quite a bit of money on your FEMA premiums, your National Flood Insurance premiums, but your FEMA will typically exclude coverage for property below the lowest elevated floor. And this would basically include garages and any personal property, such as lobby furniture and lobby fixtures. In my building at the sanctuary, for example, we had 3.5 feet of muck in the garage. We had some damage in our elevator pits that were below grade, and we had a lobby that was totally destroyed. We threw out all of our lobby furniture, all of our cabinetry that was done in our lobby, all destroyed, and found out to our somewhat surprise that FEMA didn't cover any of the personalty that was in the floor below the BFE, which is the base flood elevation floor. It did cover cleanup. It did cover shoveling the muck out of our garages. It didn't cover getting into and pumping out our drains, because our drains were below level. It didn't cover any damage in our elevator pits that were below level. Fortunately, most of our elevator equipment was located on our roof, so that wasn't damaged. But two of our buildings had elevator controls below grade, and those elevators, they were out for quite a number of weeks until they could get repaired, and FEMA did not cover that. So we were quite surprised about this. Interestingly, we had been paying the National Flood Insurance premiums for contents. You know, it covers both building and contents. There's two levels of FEMA coverage. One is the building structure and one is contents. We have been paying premiums for contents, and the only contents we really had under the first residential floor was our lobby. And to find out that we'd been paying a premium for contents when FEMA didn't cover the lobby furniture, we were actually paying premiums for nothing. Fortunately, those premiums were quite small. Because we were an elevated building, our FEMA premiums were quite small, and the contents portion of it was an insignificant part of the premiums. But we were surprised to learn that we'd been paying premiums all this year for contents that weren't even going to be covered by FEMA, by the National Flood Insurance Program. Yeah. But you have to be very careful. As we have found out, there are insurance agents who deal solely in coastal communities, specialize in FEMA coverage, specialize in National Flood Insurance coverage. There is private coverage available, very expensive. And your FEMA coverage is somewhat limited per unit, both on the building side and on the content side. Building side, it's $250,000 per unit. On the content side, it's $150,000 per unit. Thankfully, in our building, we have 63 units. So if you multiply that by those numbers, you get a sufficient amount of coverage from FEMA. If you're in a personal residence, you have a totally different issue. I have this affinity towards barrier islands. I own a home on a barrier island outside of New York, and our FEMA coverage is $250,000 for the building and $150,000 for contents. And people who own private residences should well be aware that the FEMA coverage is somewhat limited and be concerned about that. We had enough coverage, but our insurance didn't cover everything we thought it did.
Excellent. Yeah. I learned something there. FEMA's pretty crazy.
You know, it's been a very educational winter for us here, as we've all learned a lot. You know, one of the things I think Craig and I, we discussed was, after learning this about FEMA, we decided that we ought to have someone take a look at all of our insurance policies to make sure that all of our policies cover what we think they cover, and that there's no duplication of coverage in the various policies that we have. As I said, we have 5 buildings, 4 condominium associations. 2 buildings are one condominium association, and the other buildings are their own separate condominium association. And then a community association, which governs all of the common areas, all of our pools, our landscaping, our sand dunes, our tennis courts, our clubhouse. And so we have a multitude of insurance policies. Each of our condominium associations have their own coverage, and our community association has their own coverage. And it's really important that you make sure that you think you have the coverage you want. We found out, to some surprise, that in some instances we didn't. One of the issues we had, we did not get any insurance for our community association, and our insurance agent had us name the community association as an additional insured on the condominium association's insurance policies. Unfortunately, there was an exclusion for any damage relating to water events on all the condominium association policies, and naming the community association that owned the pool sort of excluded any damage we had in our pool. So we had to get an endorsement. We've been without insurance in our pool for quite a bit of time, unexpectedly, and had to get a special endorsement to override the exclusion that was in the condominium association policies that named our community association as an additional insured. So it was a breathtaking moment that, whoa, we don't have insurance for our pool. Fortunately, we've had no claims to our pool during the course of the period of time that the insurance lapsed on that pool, but now things are straightened out. But the lesson to be learned, I think, and I've learned it in other situations that I've been involved in, insurance agents and brokers don't necessarily read the policies and read the endorsements to give you advice. And I highly recommend hiring someone to actually read the policies to tell you what your insurance covers. To me, it's blown my mind now twice to learn about what coverage we are missing and what coverage we're paying for numerous times by the multitude of policies that each of these associations have. Someone really needs to sit down, and we hired someone who does not sell insurance, whose profession is to assess the risks and tell you and educate you as to what your insurance policies cover, what they don't cover, how they're duplicative, and just give you the advice and educate you. Highly worth the money that you would have to pay.
Great advice. Absolutely. And I don't see it happening. This is something new you brought up. And they all should, because they do all have voids in their policies that they don't know about. Yeah.
And get a declarations page and a list of endorsements, but nobody knows really what the... And you don't even get your policies often until after you've paid your premiums. You know, you get copies of your policies sometimes 60 to 90 days after you've paid your premiums. You finally get copies of your policies, and you don't really know what your coverage is, because you have a list of endorsements that seem to be explaining what the endorsements cover, but they don't necessarily really.
Absolutely.
Anyway, my advice to all these associations, get someone to review your insurance. It's really important.
I agree entirely. We touched on some of this, that the complexities of being in a leadership position on a board, and even being in the association management side. A lot of our listeners will be community association managers. What do you see changes coming in play as what you expect from a community association management company or association manager, as we get more laws put into place, and what has happened since Surfside and all the hurricanes and issues with insurance carriers now, the knowledge base has gotten expanded greatly. So what are your thoughts on that?
Surfside has created a monster in Florida. There are more condominium association regulations in Florida than I would say in every other state combined. Not as a result of Surfside, but the Florida Sunshine Laws are extremely strict. In there can't be a majority of board members on any board to get together to discuss anything relating to the condominium association matters without it being an actual board meeting. So if we have 9 members on any of our boards, we can't have 5 board members get together to discuss condominium issues without posting this meeting, opening this meeting to all unit owners, and giving all unit owners an opportunity to speak at this meeting. And we're very careful about monitoring the sunshine laws. For governmental entities, it's even more strict. You can't have 2 members of any governmental entity get together to discuss anything relating to the governmental entity without violating the sunshine laws. But for condominium associations, you can have no more than a majority. Our condominium associations, as opposed to our homeowners association, have only 5 board members on each board. So you can't even have 3 of those board members get together to discuss condominium issues without having, without it being posted, having it considered to be a board meeting in essence. Our community association, our homeowners association, has 9 board members, so we can get 4 members together to discuss condominium issues. And it sometimes is an issue to get things done when you would love to meet in executive session and just have the board members meet. There are 2 exceptions when the board members can meet without unit owners being present and without unit owners having an opportunity to speak. And that's when you're discussing employee issues or you're discussing litigation issues where attorney-client privilege may be at issue. But other than that, a board meeting must be open, must be posted, must be open in conspicuous places. There are rules about posting. It must be open to all unit owners, and all unit owners must be given the opportunity to speak at the meeting. And so that makes board meetings a little more difficult than anywhere else that I've been accustomed to sitting on boards. And I sit on a lot of not-for-profit boards. Only in Florida do you have the sunshine rules. But surfs, that wasn't a creation of Surfside. I don't want that to be thought of as a Surfside issue. But Surfside did create a multitude of legislative initiatives creating sort of havoc within the condominium and homeowners association governance boards. They have required lots of reserves, structural integrity reserves, they call it SARs. They have required structural audits and structural inspections of every building periodically. These inspection reports must be made available to all unit owners, must be posted conspicuously on the website or in other conspicuous locations. So these initiatives have created, there are now 2 reserves required for each condominium association. One reserve is your typical reserve for non-structural items. The good news about those reserves is that they can be pooled and they can be moved from one item to another item, but you're now legislative required, statutorily required, a structural reserve cannot be pooled. It can be only used for the item in which this reserve should be, where the money should be allocated for that item. So you can't pool your structural reserve items, which is an issue. It really is an issue. It's also caused your quarterly common charges or monthly common charges to have risen dramatically to account for these reserves. And again, my advice is don't let your management team do the reserves without speaking to someone who is adroit in establishing these reserves. It's very complex stuff trying to determine what the useful life of all your structural elements in your building are and how much you need to allocate towards each item so that when the useful life of the item has reached its end of its life, you have enough money in the reserve to replace it. And so to do this on your own is a very difficult task. To do this with a professional reserve study person who's certificated in this kind of work is really essential. And we rely heavily on these professionals to help us with our reserves.
Yeah, you touched on that, the rising costs, especially out where you are, again, even more so. Are there any initiatives in place that you've had to do over the last year or so to reduce those costs from like key service provider vendors, whether it's landscaping, association management, but you're in-house there, security, any of the other major insurance brokers, deductibles, anything that you've had to be able to look at differently?
I can name a couple of things. I think our Hurricane Ian, which wasn't even part of last year, of Hurricanes Helene and Milton. Hurricane Ian tore the roof off 3 of our 5 buildings. We had an inspector come and made a determination that one of the buildings was not affected by Ian. It was actually affected by the useful life of the roof. So there was emergency legislation in place that if your roof was damaged in Hurricane Ian, and I think the same legislation was in place for Helene and Milton especially, which was a wind event more than a storm surge event for us on the West Coast of Florida, that the insurance company would have to provide you with the same coverage while you were in the midst of repairing your roof. But one building where it was determined that the roof was not damaged as a result of Ian, in order for them to get wind coverage, they had to spend several $100,000 to get wind coverage while their roof was not repaired, waiting for roofers to come and put a new roof on. And there was a special assessment just for wind coverage. But interestingly, our deductible for hurricane wind damage, which damaged our roof in Ian, we never reached our deductible at all. Our deductible, I believe, was either 5 or 7% of the property value of the building. And the roof was a $2.5 million assessment that had to be levied. None of it reached the value, the 7% of the value of the building. And so it was all paid for via an assessment. So deductibles, I would always say, raise your deductibles to the highest limit that you think you can afford to pay, because it will greatly reduce your premium. With hurricane deductibles are the worst, that you don't get an opportunity. 5% of the value of the building is probably the lowest deductible you can get. But if you're not going to reach that, you may as well reduce your premiums and go to 7 or 10% of the value of your building. We have always been advised by all of our insurance brokers, increase your deductibles to where you're comfortable paying, or where you think you're not going to make a claim in the event you have damage. Because if you're not going to make a claim, there's no point having a low deductible. Same with personal insurance as well. We've just been advised and had someone look over our personal insurance. And the first comment they say is, your deductibles are too low. You can save thousands of dollars on your insurance premiums by raising your deductible to a level that you'd be satisfactorily comfortable paying in the event of a casualty. Some of the other initiatives we've been undertaking are quite interesting, both as a result, I'm going to mention two, both as a result of the storm surge from Hurricane Helene. We incurred some pretty severe damage to our sand dunes, which is really the first place of defense when there is a storm surge. Our sand dunes were flattened. We have been working with a coastal engineer very closely in order to help restore our sand dunes. In addition, both on the north and south ends of our complex, we have a building on each side of us that is higher in off the ground, higher off the with a higher elevation than our buildings. And we had a tsunami sort of run both on the north and south end of our buildings that ran into our property, because the two buildings on either the north and south end of our property was a higher elevation than our buildings. We are trying again with the help of a coastal engineer to sort of retrofit some of the property between the buildings on the north side and the south side of our property with berms, walls, or ditches to sort of avoid the flow of water coming directly into our building. But we are now in the process of approving a huge planting of sea grapes, seagrass, and other items in our dunes that were destroyed by Hurricane Helene to take root in our dunes. And really, it's the dunes are the first line of defense, and the dunes need to be built to stop the water flow. We are told that our dunes really help prevent further damage to our property than the damage that it actually existed. The other initiative we're undertaking is a very unique initiative, and that's a flood mitigation. We're actually planning on building walls around with panels, 5 feet high panels around all of our buildings that can be installed at each opening. We have 37 garage openings within our five buildings, and we're going to place these side panels where flat panels can be fit into in before a storm comes to seal off all of our openings and all of our buildings. There's a company, and it's an interesting, there's a bunch of companies. The company we're using is called Garrison Flood Control. And you can go on their website and see the Hammerhead system, for example, has been used very successfully up and down the west coast of Florida. And we are planning on inserting these panels in all of our openings in the event that there is a storm facing us. There are some logistics involved. We store these panels when there is no storm, how you educate your maintenance staff to install these panels, the time it takes to install these panels, and the time it takes to clean up the rest of our property to prepare for a storm. Milton came upon us with very little notice, and our maintenance staff worked diligently in protecting our property from damage from Milton, without regard to having anything to do with these panels. So we're entering into a contract with a disaster recovery company based in Tampa, who is going to assist us both pre-storm and post-storm, so we won't have to rely on thinking ahead. Before Helene came, during conference calls with management, we decided to arrange for our disaster recovery team to come. We arranged for our elevator repair company to come. And so we were first on everyone's list after the Ringling Bridge opened from Sarasota to allow people back on Longboat Key after the storm. We had, as I said, 50 workers here to start cleaning up our property. We also had our elevator company here to start repairing the elevator. We were just lucky that we thought about all of this in advance. There were other community associations that waited for weeks to get their elevator company there. We actually called our pool company because we knew our pool was going to be filled with water and our filtering system would be shot. And so we really were proactive in arranging for all of this in advance. We don't want to be proactive again. We want to be proactive now to make sure that all the people are there when the time comes. Yeah. Hopefully, as we said, we've just signed a contract with one of these recovery disaster specialists. Hopefully we never have to use them. I mean, that's really the goal. The weather report for the local television channel last night said, you know, it's now we're starting to think about the beginning of hurricane season June 1. This year will never be anything like last year. Nothing could be like last year. I wonder where he's getting his information from, because the storm season starts June 1, and we're all a little restless about what it's going to be. I've actually found a climate controlled storage facility to keep my car that I keep down here. And this summer, I'm not taking any chances in keeping it in our garage until I know that this flood mitigation concept will be installed and will work. I really don't want to get involved with insurance adjusters over the summer, negotiating the price that they're going to pay me for my two cars that were destroyed. So people are taking their own initiatives to sort of protect themselves and their property.
Yeah, we learned a lot, I think, and it's going to continue on. I agree. And things are going to keep changing. So
for sure,
we got to keep changing with it. So that's a challenge for association management and any of the other service vendors.
Yeah. So you asked me some of the things that I think transparency, I know it's an overused word. It's really so important. Communication and transparency in that communication is really essential. Don't ever, management or board members should never be afraid to tell their unit owners the truth, even though it's going to be sometimes, you know, people will harass you. You know, sometimes I walk out to our pool, walk out to the beach, and I am totally stopped by everyone I pass. Are we going to have another assessment or what's going to happen here? But really tell people the truth, tell them what's happening, what's going on, what we're doing. And we've kept people informed. We have a newsletter that goes out on a quarterly basis, and we have our board meetings. The legislature has demanded that board meetings take place, at least one board meeting a quarter. We've had board meetings every month, but we've never had board meetings in June, July, or August. And now we're going to have a board meeting even in the summer. The legislature requires that. Another thing the legislature did, which I think is interesting and actually a good idea, although my co-board members don't think so, every board member of a condominium association or homeowners association must take 4 hours of educational classes before by June 30th of this year for their minute to serve on a board. And thereafter, they need 1 hour of refreshing courses every year thereafter to continue to serve on the board. I think it's a great idea. I think the more knowledge that board members have, the better that they can serve. I'm all in favor of that. All of the local law firms and other organizations have created classes that board members can take online at their leisure and get certified that they've passed this. And we're being very careful and making sure that all of our board members do take the educational classes to certify themselves that they are, in fact, certified to serve as a member of our board. And it really has helped. I think the more education board members have. On the other hand, we've had a board member say, I don't have time to take a 4 hour class. I'm getting off the board. This is getting ridiculous. And so the other thing board members should look for is directors and officers liability insurance. This has become a very litigious society. I would not have wanted to be a board member of Surfside when that building collapsed because the board members have been sued. And I think, you know, board members may not always be right, but they certainly try their best. And they're subject to getting sued in the event that people think they were grossly negligent in some of the actions they took. Before I get on a board, I always want to see the directors and officers liability insurance policy. I think it's just important. You want to know that if your board makes an error, your board gets sued, at least the defense, you may not be liable, but you may have defense costs that need to be covered. And at the very least, you should know that there is an insurance policy in place to protect yourself from those litigious people who are in your community. And communities have become litigious. I think there is a great deal of entitlement of community residents now who expect much more from their board than they did even years ago. You know, the email barrage that we all get, the landscaping isn't up to snuff, the pool temperature is too low. I can just blow your mind by the number of emails that not only I receive, but our management company, our managers receive, our in-house managers receive on a daily basis. I think at one point, right after the storms, they were getting, you know, 100 emails a day from unit owners, which basically took their whole day. And so we tried to put things in place that unit owners should first contact members of their board who should siphon messages going to our management, because our managers were spending the better part of the day just answering emails, which was really an inefficient way to operate. So efficiency is really important. Transparency is really important. And communication is really important.
And I like it.
I always say those things to me. You know, everyone understands and everyone should understand that these are volunteer positions that we all do. You know, I spent 45 years working as a lawyer so I could retire and enjoy my life. And I'd like to give something back to the community that I love. I don't want to give it back on a 12-hour workday. So that's why we have great management in place. And hopefully people do respect that these are volunteer positions.
I want to thank you for this. You've set a high bar for everybody else. A lot of great information. And I know that the listeners are really going to enjoy listening to this. And I hope they pass it along to other board members also. There's just so much really good information that I've seen come out over the last couple of years, but not many people have talked about it a lot. So
well, I'm glad to talk about it. And I love my community. I love being here. And for most part, I love the people who I serve as their president. They're all respectful for the most part. They're all kind. They all want my attention and I give to them all I can. And we try to make life better. And I have to say, even with the storms that came in September and October, this has been a really great winter in Florida. And I think every morning I wake up, I pinch myself, how lucky I am to be where I am. I mean, it's just a great community, great people, love it down here, and expect to be here for many years to come. So
thank you for having me.
I appreciate it.
And just in closing, if anybody wants to learn more about the sanctuary, you can visit their website, and it's, I believe, lbksanctuary.com, correct? And if you want to connect with me or any of our companies, you can visit pinnaclesas.com or pinnaclecam.com. And until the next time, this has been the Florida Association Excellent Podcast. Thank you.